So, welcome everyone to compiler construction. My name is Michael Petter and I'm going to guide you through that lecture for the next half a year. Let's maybe start it first with a few organizational items. So, according to what Tom Online says at least, this should be a lecture for either bachelor's or master's with 5 ECTS. So far, but it's no surprise, I think. So let's talk a little bit about the prerequisites. So what should be the lectures that you should have taken already so far? That's especially important for the ones who are who are not yet masters or have come from another university. So the first prerequisite would be to have somehow had an introduction to computer science, part 1 and 2 for our institute here. So that would especially mean that you should be familiar with something like Java, because there will be tutorials, and in the tutorial sessions we at some point need to program a little bit for sake of not having 8 or 10 variants of the same thing in different languages. We will establish Java as the standard. Next thing is the theoretical computer science lecture. That would especially mean that we will base a lot of the things in our course on things like automata theory and formal languages. Especially the first part of the lecture will be about how to actually efficiently implement the topics from theoretical computer science in an actual computer program. Then, of course, there will be points that are quite similar to the ones that you've heard in technical computer science, especially in the last part of the lecture, where everything is about generating target-specific code of your machine, or in general, create code for some kind of hardware. And of course, throughout the whole lecture, we will be needing something like grundlegende Algorithmen, or basic algorithms, stuff like sorting, or stuff like finding circles and graphs and all that. So your basic tool set of algorithms. So that is what you should bring into the whole thing. Especially if you don't have any foundations in theoretical computer science, you might not have as much fun as the people who have. So that might be a thing to look up beforehand and maybe consider to even drop the whole thing if that overwhelms you. If you have more interest in the things that we do here, you might also be interested in, that's kind of the Amazon part, you might also be interested in. So right now we also offer the lecture for virtual machines. So that is on the, what we have here is second part on the code generation for the input that you get from different languages, like the procedural languages or the functional languages or logical languages, and we introduce machine concepts that are good in interpreting that kind of code. So that is what we do in virtual machines, and we do that more extensively as we do that, or more intensively, better to say, as we do it here. So that would be virtual machines. It's in the same semester as this one here, so you might want to consider that if you're interested in that and want to create a kind of a special topic around the compiler construction things. Then there's the program optimization lecture. That one is in winter semester. It's kind of the spiritual second part of that lecture here. So where we will stop in this one is where we will have a kind of a naive code generation scheme for kind of a C-like language. This one will pick up and will guide you through how to not emit dumb code, but more elaborate code. Still dumb, but not as dumb as this one. Then we will also offer something like the programming languages lecture, where we will focus on specific language features that are not covered in standard compiler construction language. Then there's also the well-beloved practical course in compiler construction. There's still room. We only have one participant so far. Yeah. We might not do that this time, but yeah, we'll see. And there's also seminars in the topics of, or in the general area of compiler construction. So that's what you can use to intensify your compiler construction experience. What we will be bringing to our deal here is some materials, like you have seen me fiddling around with this pen and a lot of cables and technical stuff. That all is for the purpose of recording the lectures. You can find the lectures on our portal, which is ttt for teleteaching dot in dot tuum dot de, and from there you will have to navigate your way to the current semester. I think on the homepage of that of our chair, we also have a direct link to the recordings for this lecture. Of course, you will also obtain the slides for this lecture. There will there's also a related literature list online, and we will be especially focusing on one item of that, that is the compiler design book from Wilhelm Seidel and Hack. And yeah, if you're native English or non-German, you might want to go to the library if you want to have one of the, those, because they have hard copies of that in English. And there's also a German version available online. So yeah, pick what you want. But you should be assured you don't necessarily need to have one of those. It's just another source of information. If you can't cope with the way that I speak or with the way that I pronounce things, that might happen. I'm not a native speaker. Then you might want to consider also other explanations, because clearly Wilhelm Seidel and Hack are also native speakers. Or are not native speakers, so yeah. But maybe the written things tend to be more understandable than spoken ones. But in general, a lot of the things that you find in the slides here have made their way to the books anyway. So there's a lot of common things in there, and I don't know whether you necessarily need to have that book. So maybe you can also do just with the tutorials and the slides. Yeah, then for the part where we actually generate some code, we will have a tool that will serve for visualizing how the particular code fragment actually works on such a machine, because we will target a kind of a abstract machine. There's no real hardware for that, so we need a kind of a simulator, and that's what the VAM tool, Visualization of Abstract Machines tool, does for you. So that's also effort from our side. And then there's of course also other tools for the other parts of the lectures, like the front end part of the compiler, where there's certain generators like JFlex and CUP, and those can also be obtained either from our chair directly or at some other place in the internet. Okay, so that is what we will use throughout the lecture. Other organizational stuff. Well, everyone that has made it into that room by now will probably have already known about this one. So Thursday from 2 to 4 is our time slot. For the tutorial, the TomOnline by default introduces two time slots for the tutorials, but they're never quite that practical. They're just arbitrary time slots. And so we usually set up a Doodle where you can put your desired time frames in. And if you do so by Friday, that tomorrow, until 17 o'clock, then we will consider your vote for such a time slot in order to come up with two alternatives. Well, usually we have enough people for two tutorial courses. That might change during the year, but in the beginning we usually have needs for two of those slots, so we will try to choose something where we can cover the most people, and that will, should we find a room for that, be the new tutorial sessions. So this is to be determined. You can help for that by giving your vote until Friday the 28th at 5 o'clock in the evening, and you will find the URL for the survey on the homepage for this lecture. In case that you couldn't find it so far, there's the URL .in.fum.de, and from there you have to navigate to Lehre, and there should be compiled instruction listed on that. Okay. Then, next frequently asked question is on the exam, as it is also the case for the programming languages. We will have one exam in the end, which will be in the summer semester. There will be none in the winter. So it's just one exam. Of course, I understand that due to scheduling issues, you might run into scheduling conflicts, like having two exams on the same date. If that should be the case, please contact me, and we will arrange a kind of a alternative date for that specific case. But the thing that I want to say is there's no repeated exam, so you can't just participate in one exam and also in a second one. Either way, should you have a kind of a replacement date or the original date, you still need to sign up for the exam with the TUM Online or campus tool that you probably should know by now quite well, and there won't be a separate event for something like a replacement exam. You still need to register for the original one. So please keep that in mind. There's just one exam, so if you want to have a grade in the end, then register for that exam. We also have the idea of mini projects. People might know that already from a few of the last events, and the idea is that you can earn yourself a bonus to your final grade. Should you succeed in the exam, you can have that bonus. It will be not possible to pass the exam just because of that bonus, so you won't be lifted from 4.3 to 4.0, but should you have something better than 4.0 or 4.0 itself, the bonus applies. The mini projects this year will come in the form of a tutorial in a specific compiler related topic that you have to come up with, and in the end we will initiate a workshop in compiler construction where we schedule all of these tutorials, and people who are interested in these specific topics can take part in that and listen to your to your tutorials and maybe even start to hack a little bit, depending on what you have actually prepared for that. So you're supposed to prepare a tutorial in that case. You will have a 1 hour time slot, so roughly 45 minutes or 50 minutes of content should be there that you prepare for that, and you can, you're free to be creative in the sense that you can either have something where you have quite detailed instructions for people, where you just lead them through your topic, or you might have something like a short introductory talk and then a short kind of mini project where you run around and guide people or whatever. You're free to choose your own format for that. But in the end, it should be successful in the sense that people should take away a few main things. What this should be is actually on your particular topic, but in general, people should be able to take away something from that. What could be possible projects? Well, we haven't fixed them yet. I will give them to you in the middle of the semester. That is because it's quite hard to come up with these topics, and I know for sure that I will not even see half of you in the middle of the semester, so it would be a waste to create 130 topics as people inscribed into that. So, half time we will distribute the things, and you can start preparing your tutorials. Yeah, so these are kind of exemplary topics. Bless you. Exemplary topics in there, and all of them will have something or another to do with the topics from the lecture. So there will be topics around generating different parts of a compiler. There will be focus on front end, there will be focus on back end. There's stuff that deals with grammars, with automata, with attribute evaluation, with versioning of grammars, and with generating actual code, obtain code from already existing parsers, and all that. So there's plenty of room where you can kind of find something for you. Well, we will try to come up with a few more of those, of course, but in the end, that will be the idea. About the lecture itself, we will have certain topics, and the ones that we will be able to do in there will be, of course, we will be talking about things like regular expressions and finite automata as for the very first part of the compiler. Then we will use that knowledge to specify and implement scanner components for a compiler. Then we will talk about context-free grammars and pushdown automata in order to get the tool set to come up with syntax analysis systems. We have talked about that. We will cover the next phase, which is attribute systems or semantic analysis of your of your parse tree, and that is done with these attribute systems. And as a typical example of a semantic analysis, we will do type checking. Then we will have a look at how to come up with code generation schemes for, in this case, a register machine. And we might also talk about something like register assignments or also basic optimizations, depending on how far we will come with our topics here. Considering that we have the Thursday slot, and Thursday in summer semester is always plagued with these bank holidays, we might not see the optional things at the bottom, but we'll see. Is there any question on lecture, tutorial, or any other general remarks? Yes, please.
So how is the tutorial organized? Is the tutorial will the guide onwards, or is the tutorial exclusively for the mini projects?
The purpose of the tutorial is to come up with training for the content of the lecture. So that has nothing to do directly with the mini projects. That is more about kind of preparing you for the exam, for example, in the sense that, well, at some point I will need to confront you with written tasks that you should solve in the end. And the tutorial gives you once a week a sheet where there's prepared written tasks that you solve with the help of your instructor. Yeah. So the purpose is also, well, not that the instructor should show you just what is what will come out of that, he should work with you on that task. So it's never a thing that you just get the solution, but the instructor would probably call some arbitrary student to come to the blackboard or whiteboard in that case and start working on the particular tutorial exercise. And I would heavily recommend to really have a look at these tutorial sheets and try to solve these exercises. Otherwise, if you just try to follow the lecture by yourself, you will be quite surprised how little the lecture actually helps in understanding all the algorithms. And that's even me saying that. So it's good for introducing the algorithms, but you need to do them yourselves in order to really understand what's happening there. Is that?
Yeah,
that's okay. You also had a question?
Will lectures be recorded?
Yes, the lecture will be recorded. That's why I have this funky things here. Good. Yes, please.
Have you already set up a time for the final exam?
I don't do that. That is determined by a central facility at the TU, which performs a lot of black magic and you know what, and in the end they come up with a date. I don't have an influence on that. It usually is out there 2 months in the semester or something. Don't know exactly. So I get the same notification that you get, that there is something. I don't get any notification at all, but I can check regularly and I see it the same time that you see it. So I don't have an influence on it. That was...
Same question,
okay.
To what Java is expected?
You should be able to set up your own program. You don't need to have special library skills in the sense that you need to set up a large-scale web service with whatever, but you should be able to kind of implement an algorithm in that. So you need to somehow know about standard data structures like lists and arrays and all that, and you should be able to cope with that.
Can we study in between for a week or two and understand Java and then implement the algorithm?
So I didn't get the
second. Can we learn Java in between and then?
You can at least try. I don't know for sure that on the first exercise sheet there already is a task that requires implementation of a Java program. However, it's just, well, it's all kind of command line programs. There's no graphical user interface or other funky things. It's just about how to implement an automaton in Java. So it's about data structures, lists, arrays, loops on the arrays. In that sense, programming Java on that level is probably quite similar to something like programming C. So should not be too difficult. Maybe have a look in the standard libraries a little bit, like how do you create a list, dynamically growing list in that sense, and how to iterate over that, and that should probably do it for the start. And Yeah, it's also not too much about classes in the beginning, so. Good. Yeah. Okay. So, let's maybe dive right in. Let's remove my valuable painting and dive right into the whole thing. So, compilers, for an introduction to those, let's have a kind of a look in, at the idealized extremes that you find when you somehow operating in the area of compilers. And one of the extremes that you find out there is the concept of the interpreter. An interpreter is, in from an idea, the a concept where you have a black box, which is the interpreter, and the black box can have an input in this sense that can have, get a program and an input. It consumes that and gives you an output. So the thing here is that it's just one black box. It doesn't tell you what it does internally, especially in the extreme form of what interpreting means is that it usually doesn't do any sophisticated pre-computations in there, but just tries to cope with whatever it finds in the program text at the time that it comes to a certain line of code and tries to do the best with that, with the input that still remains to be consumed. Yeah, there's plenty of them out there, and they have their benefits. There's, as I said, there's not much need for pre-computation on the program text, so there's a small startup time, and usually these things are quite easy to implement because they don't have all these additional computations that might lead to some more clever implementations later on, but you just do the naive thing and are happy that it works at all. Of course, there's also a downside of that specific approach. Well, if you just deal with instructions of your program as soon as you find them, you might end up with having to do things twice. You don't keep something like a context or something like already done steps. You don't cache anything or whatever. And that means that you might run into situations where you just have to redo things over and over and over again. Just imagine subroutine calls in your program. If you happen to find an invocation of a subroutine, you might need to locate the actual position of that thing within your file. If you have several calls to your thing, you might need to scan your program several times for these things. So, in its extreme, the interpreter is a thing that that has a longer runtime than a purely compiler-based approach. So that is. That. Then there's the concept of or the classical extreme of such a thing, which is the typical compiler. That is a thing which separates the former black box into two black boxes, where the first one is called the compiler, or the compiler run, and in the second one we let the machine do something. And in terms of input and output, the compiler, the classical compiler, just obtains program code and produces target code or machine code, which can then be run on the machine directly without any further help, and can be used for several inputs and produce hopefully the same output as the interpreter has produced with the same program and the same input. So there's two phases now, and the first phase produces code that is executed on the machine. Of course, there's certain implications on that. First of all, it needs time to produce that code. That might be cost intensive, depending on what language and what compiler you actually have. That might do a lot of work internally to then save up on runtime whenever you run the concrete program with a new input. So the goal is to optimize for the runtime on new inputs, and trade-off is that you need to invest more time in compilation and also maybe on the complexity of the compiler. In practice, however, you will see that a lot of the systems that we find out there are not clearly interpreters or compilers in the classical sense anymore. There's a lot of compile time approaches creeping into interpreted systems, and also a lot of interpreter approaches creeping into the compiler systems. Just consider these just-in-time compilation engines that are out there that started from an interpretation approach and are now doing quite heavy compilation work during runtime. Or imagine these compiler systems that are parameterized with runtime obtained data, like these profiled systems where you let your program run on a few exemplary benchmarks, obtain runtime information from that and feed that into another compilation run that then tries to optimize your program for inputs that are similar to the ones that you have run your instrumented code with. So there's not so clear boundaries anymore between those things, but they are kind of mixed things in most cases that you find. But the classical ones are this just plain compilers and plain interpreters. A classical compiler can be segmented into several parts. There's still remember that the compiler is the one where you have program code as input and target code as output. But if you open the black box in between, you will see that there's several components in there also. There's the analysis box and the synthesis box, and in between they are connected with the so-called internal representation, which is a form of the program code that is a more abstract level. It optimizes away a lot of the peculiarities that your source language might have. You might have five different types of loops. They will all be somehow fused and normalized into just one representation of a loop, for example, and other things like that. So you will have some kind of internal representation. It might also be that you even have compiler systems where you have different front ends for different languages that all compile into the same internal representation, and you just have one common, highly optimized synthesis and semantic analysis phase where you try to optimize as much as you can and benefit from the fact that you're joining forces with other groups. So, anyway, there's the internal representation, and apart from that, we have the boxes of analysis and synthesis. And for the first part of our lecture, we will focus on the analysis box or analysis phase. So, this one here. So, this one has as input the program code, and somehow creates some intermediate form where we'll see what that will actually be in some cases. Yeah, the analysis box. If we open that, we will see that there's also several components in there. There's the scanner component. That is the first one that you see that is connected to the program code. So that is the first component that your program runs through. The scanner has the purpose of it's the first contact to your program, and it serves the purpose for kind of categorizing the things that it sees in classes of input, in the sense that it will create tokens from the input. A token is just a small fragment of the input that has something to do with each other, and it will create a sequence of these tokens out of the program code. So that is the output of the scanner, and that is then fed into the next part, which is the so-called parser. The parser is there for syntactic analysis. So with these fragments of input that the scanner has generated, the parser then tries to create a hierarchy structure out of the token stream. So from a plain stream, which is just a chain of or a sequence of items, the parser selects the units that it sees that belong together in some according to some specific rule set, and constructs small tree-like constructs that it then uses to connect to each other, also in form of a tree, but then a larger tree, and step by step tries to establish the so-called parse tree of your input program. So these three things can be seen as the hierarchical structure of a program. And in the end, this parse tree will be the output of the parser in form of the syntax or parse tree, depending on how you actually define the where your parser ends and where your post computation ends. And you might have seen something like the syntax tree or the parse tree of your program already in the introductory courses. The structure of such a program is, in cases, it's just the input file, which then is consists of, for example, classes. Classes consists of names and bodies. The bodies of these classes now have a set of attributes and set of methods and set of constructors or something. That is this hierarchical structure of your input program, and that is created by the parser component. So, with your program now being in the form of a syntax tree or parse tree, we get the next component of the analysis, which is then the semantic analysis. I've given you already the hint that there's something like a type checker involved in there, at least in our C-like example language here. So there's a box that now tries to come up with a few semantic properties that couldn't be represented in these hierarchical structures before, but nevertheless still are necessary for an efficient execution of the program later on, and thus are important to have because we want to have some kind of at least at some part optimized code afterwards. So also for correctness, you might want to consider a few properties that your semantic analysis is trying to establish here. So there's another phase that performs semantic analysis, and that an example for that might be this type checker, which goes through your syntax tree. And for the example of the type checker, each time that it finds a leaf that carries that represents an identifier. Identifiers are the compiler word for the name of a variable or a function or a class or whatever. So In those cases, you speak of identifiers, and the languages that we see here all have as kind of a precondition that before you at some point use your identifier to achieve things like access an attribute or call a method, you need to define that beforehand. So you need a relation holding there that the definition is somehow found in the syntax tree at a certain point before the run through this syntax tree reaches the use of such an identifier. So you need some kind of definition use analysis in there in order to check whether an identifier is defined before it is used. A type checker then also, of course, wants to verify that the use of this identifier is in the right context depending on the type that this identifier has been declared with. So the type checker, after the definition use relation is established on these things, then goes even further and tries to see in what context this identifier has been used. For example, if you try to call something, it knows that the identifier must have been declared as something that is actually callable. So it will go back to the definition and actually check whether the things that you have defined that identifier with are specifying that as, for example, a method name or procedure name or whatever. So that is what your semantic analysis is all about. For now, we will start with the phase that comes right at the beginning, which is the lexical analysis. Remember what the lexical analysis does is, well, it's a component that we call the scanner, and as input it gets the program code, and as output it produces a stream or sequence of tokens. In a concrete example, you might have a source code part, for example, that expression, XYZ plus 42. Then the scanner runs, and instead of the original string XYZ plus 42, the scanner will give you a sequence of units of interest of your language. So we will see how it actually determines what units of interest for your language actually are, but the end result will be something like it will have detected that the first part of your input has something to do with each other and is to be interpreted as a common thing. Thus will be a token, and the token class will be also communicated to the next phase, which means that it will somehow be marked as, well, the concept with which the scanner has associated that token with. So X, Y, Z, well, we have pretty definitely already talked about identifiers. Well, X, Y, Z is such an example. It might be a variable name or whatever, and that is things that we call identifiers. So that will be also marked as being an identifier. Then we see another red box, which just comprises one character, a plus, and, well, that's also considered to be one unit of interest for our language, and, well, plus, as well as minus or dot or whatever you find in there, is, at least in our context, for our scanner here, the concept of an operator. So that is what it is marked with, and then we have 42, which is also a composed token, composed of several characters. They seem to belong together, and in our case they belong together because they form an integer constant. Yeah, maybe they are also just considered as a member of a common group, literals, but that depends on how you set up your scanner. So, all in all, a token is considered to be a sequence of characters. They together form a unit that we can then throw at the parser to come up with the hierarchical structure of my program. And these tokens are not living just in isolation to each other. They're more than just plain sequences of characters. They also come with the category that they are considered to fall into in form of the token class. So what you've already seen are these names or identifiers. Examples are this XYZ or pi. Then there's constants, or also literals, this 42, also once again pi in numeric form, but also string constants like this ABC here. Then there's this, the other types, there's operators, plus, minus, times, whatever, and there's also reserved terms like if, int, class, public, or whatever. So these are special character sequences that would maybe fall into the same pattern or scheme as the identifiers do, but they are kind of special cases of these names and are considered to be reserved for special purposes, like whatever the language does with that. Good. Yeah, so tokens also carry their classification with them. Good. With your classified tokens, you can now already start doing something useful. For example, you can kind of filter your input files for certain things. You can, for example, throw away parts of the input that you're not interested in. Consider something like spacing, which might differ from file to file, but doesn't do anything meaningful for your particular language, so you throw it away. Of course, there's also languages where spacing is actually playing a role, and for these you wouldn't throw that away. There's comments. Languages who are just not interested in comments, others let you specify, for example, documentation within your comments. There you are particularly interested in your comments, but maybe throw away the bodies of your methods or something. So there's different purposes for that, and you might want to filter your token stream accordingly. There's also, for example, the pragmas. They might also fit into the same case as these other filter things, where you just try to collect those and interpret them differently to the rest of the compiler. That has been the way that, for example, the OpenMP statements have been translated, at least in the very beginning of OpenMP. You might even consider replacing certain tokens of particular classes with, for example, internal representations. Maybe you want to keep, for example, something like a constant pool, where you share all the values of a certain string constant, for example. Java does that. Each time that you use the same string literally in your source file is put into this. It's put into the string pool each time that you use it, but it's put into the string pool once, and in the representation of your code, you won't find the actual constant anymore, but just a reference to that specific occurrence of your constant in the constant pool. So that's how Java deals with strings, for example. That's also the reason why you might be lucky at some times comparing strings with your equal-equal operator and succeed in that. That's the cases where your strings might have originated from from literals that were used in the same input file and thus are actual references to the same constants in the constant pool. So for these, the equality operation then succeeds. But if you have created your string value from some input, of course that won't be stored in the constant pool anymore. That is a compile time constant that is just put in your memory, and only if you do these kind of normalization things with your value that might have been compared to the strings from the constant pool and then replaced by reference to that. But yeah, that's already quite deep into the way that Java does translate. Yeah. Okay, then there's also the concept of names that are found in the input identifiers. Some languages quite literally take the input names into their compilation units and use them throughout everything. There's also other approaches where you do some kind of post-processing on the names called this name mangling, where you come up with coded representation of also the types that are somehow associated with your variable, and then obtain a kind of cryptically looking name that can be translated into the complete signature of your item that you have found there. So that would be the case for C++ object files, for example. If you try to look into those, you will at first find such a mangled name which you have to re-translate into the original name, and get by that also the signature of your method, for example. And yeah, you can try that out. There's this C++ filt, I think, program that will take those mangled names and retranslate them back into your original names. Yeah, lexical analysis is then the place where you can do all these things. First of all, scanning, and then somehow filtering. If you put a filter in there, it's often historically called the sieve, kind of filters out all the things that you don't want to drop through to the next phase. They might be combined into a single component that might also be kept apart from each other. That depends on the concrete tool set that you use. It's also not that important whether you put them together or not. The general idea is just that that is the component that reads in large blocks of files and then creates new sequences of tokens that are classified with their interest. Next, is the way, how can you actually come up with such a component? Of course, you could now start and try to hack and come up with a component that actually goes there and does a get character at something of your input string, and then have a large switch casement, switch statement, or whatever you want to use for forking, and then decide what you how you want to interpret that. But that might be quite tedious. I don't know. Has anyone in here already tried to write his or her own compiler? So, oh. Well, I hope you learned something in this lecture still. But anyway, yeah. Did you write your well, input interpreter yourself?
No.
You did not?
I have used Elixir and Parser for C++, but I also use LLVM.
Yes, sorry.
For the F sharp, I also use some kind of Elixir to generate this.
So, how about you?
I wrote an interpreter for keywords in shader code, so some of the keywords were not standard conform, was just kind of an addition to the language. So,
did you do it yourself, or did you do some kind of generation?
I did this myself. So,
so you've got both.
There's the Targets compiler that actually does the compilation, but I did a pre-process for it.
there's actually both approaches in here. Oh, nice. But anyway, you now get that there are several ways that you can do that. You can do that either manually yourself. I don't know whether you kind of try to do something like these kind of spaghetti code branches and if then else and all that, or whether you do something more elaborate.
Regular expressions.
Okay. So, in general, of course you can do your things, your scanners yourself. However, this is a task that includes a lot of these boring standard if-then-else cascades or switch case statements, or even putting together a lot of regular expressions in your code and somehow use them to decide what the next thing should actually be interpreted as. And then there's also the approach of completely leaving the implementation of your scanner component to one of these generators that focuses on the purpose of partitioning your input into these tokens and their classes, and you only concentrate on telling the generator how you want to interpret your input in as classes. And that is what the generational approach is all about. You specify your token classes and let the generator provide you with a piece of source code that you can use then as a parser. Kind of this, what you say with these regular expressions, that is kind of a mixture between both of these things. In principle, these regular expression engines by themselves are also kind of mini generators for just that regular expression, and can be considered as a kind of a hybrid approach of those. But it seems that nobody has tried to implement a scanner really manually with just plain ifs and thens. Okay. Yeah, so in our case, what we do is we specify the token classes in terms of regular expressions, in fact. So these generator approaches abstract away from you writing your own program surrounding you with setup for your regular expressions, but just concentrate on plain regular expressions that you give to the generator one by one, and then generate finite automata from that are considered to be an implementation of these regular expressions, and weaves them together to generate a parser component. So for the generator part now, we specify the token classes with regular expressions. The finite implementation will consist of, well, essentially finite automata, but then we will need something to glue them together, so there's a little plus X in there that will then make the rest of that. But essentially what the generator does is create finite automata from regular expressions. So, now we have arrived at the point of the lecture where we connect to the stuff from theoretical computer science, regular expressions and finite automata it is now for the next few slides. And I know you already have had that in lectures in the past, but still, as we have people from different universities and all, we should kind of make sure that we have some kind of common grounds to start from. So I will once again try to show the few parts of regular expressions and finite automata that we need in order to progress through the rest of the stuff. So, yeah, let's dive right into that. Regular expressions. The units of which these regular expressions are composed of are characters from a set of characters called the alphabet, and that is at the same time the characters that are allowed to write your program code with. So that is the common starting ground. A finite alphabet, sigma here, of input characters, for example, the Unicode characters of a certain bit width or something. Yeah. From these units now, we can formulate expressions that are called irregular expressions. They have a certain shape that they look like. And that's work that has been done by Stephen Kleene. So you find the picture here. Yeah, regular expressions. What is a regular expression, or what are regular expressions? Well, they are comprised of, well, they can either be nothing. And since nothing is something quite tedious to write on the slides, we don't use nothing there, but instead epsilon, which should signify nothing here. So the empty string, or epsilon, is considered to be a symbol from the alphabet. Then there's your input characters from the alphabet, and it's not from the alphabet, but it's number from the it's a part of regular expressions. So yeah, not to confuse them with each other. And the characters from the alphabet themselves are also considered. Each of them would be a valid regular expression. Okay, so those are the basic units of regular expressions. Then, apart from just the basic units of regular expressions, I can also have composed regular expressions, meaning I have constructs that take smaller regular expressions and I can glue them together with other means. For example, I can write things like these here. I can put brackets around and put a pipe in between, then it's still a regular expression. I can put brackets around and put a dot in the middle, and it's still regular expression. And I can have regular expression and put star above there, and it's still a regular expression. And that way I can construct my regular expressions. So these here, for example, are valid regular expressions. And yeah, with that, you also you already see me using a certain color scheme. Yeah, projector seems to be nice enough for you to disambiguate between them. So there's the actual characters of your program code, which are white in blue, and then there's the meta symbols that came from composing regular expressions from smaller regular expressions, and those are written in pink. Yeah. Then you can also say, well, all those brackets are quite unnerving. Let's get rid of some of them. And if you want to do that, you can introduce something like the operator precedences, where clean star or the star binds more than the dot, binds more than the pipe. And finally, get rid of the dot. And with that, you come to very compact versions of your regular expressions. Then also, in practice, you might see even more operators involved with regular expressions. For example, the question mark or the plus in the index above there. And, well, those are just syntactical sugar for other operations that we already have. So we can express those already on a syntactic level. So instead of a question mark, I can also write bracket start and epsilon pipe, and then the expression that was associated with the question mark, and then end this expression. And for the plus, I can do a similar thing with concatenation. Dot and the star. You already hear me calling out the semantical names for these operators, so let's maybe dive right into semantics of regular expressions. So now that you know how the structure of regular expressions actually looks, we still need to know what these expressions actually mean. And meaning of things is always a thing that's treated by the semantics of things. So the specification of the regular expression still misses the semantics. And yeah, the semantics of regular expressions is given by sequences of characters, and by sequences of characters, I want to stress that that's the plural, so we talk about sets of sequences of characters in that sense, as a way to express what we actually mean when we put down a regular expression. So, as an example, let's look at this here. We have, as a specification, this thing that is a valid regular expression. It's just that we omitted the dot operator, and yeah, with that we get this ABAB as a valid regular expression, at least structurally. The question is now, what does that mean? And that's what we find at the semantics part. With ABAB, we just mean the set that comprises just the string ABAB. There's nothing else involved. Yeah, next example would be A pipe B. This one over here. And what do we mean when we put that down as a regular expression? Well, in that case, we are not talking about just one sequence of characters anymore, but two sequences of characters. And so the meaning of or the semantics of this regular expression is the set that comprises the sequence A, just A, and the sequence B. So the pipe means either the string that is a sequence of characters that is associated with the left part, unification with the union with a character sequence that is associated with the right part, which is B. Yeah, and then there's also other things like this AB star A. That now is something that we cannot enumerate too easily anymore in these set notations, so I have to define the semantics of that thing with a property, and that's what I do here. So A B star A means the set of all the sequences that start with an A, stop with an A, and in between they have B's, and they have B's in several, well, you can have an arbitrary number of B's in there. The only thing is that this number has to be at least zero. Well, yeah, so you can have an arbitrary number of B's in there. Okay, I hope that's nothing new to you. Good. So in order to specify what the semantics of the regular expressions actually is, well, we can do inductive definition here. You will see me using the semantic brackets here, which is considered to be the operator that maps the regular expression to its semantics in the type set of character sequences. Okay? Good. So, the semantics of the epsilon regular expression, what is that? Well, it's the set that is comprised of the empty sequence, or empty string. That's not the empty set, but it's the set that comprises the empty string. Good, then we have the semantics for a playing character. Well, that consists in terms of semantic in set that comprises exactly that character. Then we have the composed regular expressions. So there we have the semantics of a regular expression that has the star operator or clean star as its operator, and that is supposed to be clean star operation on the set of characters that is associated or that is obtained from the semantics of the sub expression E. Of course, that is just a kind of a cheating here, because I express this clean star with this one, but don't worry, I will have the definition of the clean star on the set of characters on the next page. The pipe expression, so this one here, is considered to be the union of the sets of characters that are obtained as the semantics of E1 and E2. So you do the union on those two. Remember, that's how this thing happened. You had A pipe B, and semantics of A was the sets just comprising of A. Same thing for B, and then you did the union over them, and you obtained the set comprising both. So that's that. And then there's the dot thing, which are already called the concatenation. Well, this consists in the set associated with semantics of E1 and the one from E2, and both of them connected via the composition. Well, that once again is kind of cheating, so I will give you the definitions of those things on actual sets of characters now, and clean star on a set of characters. L is for all for all elements that are within this L. We give them names WI, and we will just concatenate these words to each other, and all the combinations that we get from there will be found within the resulting set of character sequences. So I can perform arbitrary concatenations of words in there with each other, and that will generate me the clean star. That's, if you remember what happened to this B star card, well, I, for the semantics of that thing, that was taking, for example, just one element of that set. Set was B, so I, like that, would be like that. So you, I would choose my, nobody can read that, can you? But yeah, it's actually quite a task to have to, what's the, no, quite a task to, oh, it just doesn't place the cursor where it needs to go, but yeah, you can try for yourself after I finish with the lecture. Yeah, but in principle, you would choose your elements from there. You only have one element, so that's the only one that you can use for building character sequences. So first one of them would be B. Well, if you have to pick multiple of them and concatenate to each other, you only have the chance of picking B, so you put BB in there. You can put BB in there and all that. So you can choose an arbitrary natural number in here and put values from there in from the base set into your new set, and that's how you obtain all these multitudes of Bs. Okay, so much for the clean star. The concatenation of two sets of character sequences is well, kind of based on a similar principle. What you do is you select members of your first set, put them in front of members that you select from the second set. And with that, you just try to get all the permutations, and if you're done with that, you have your the set that is created from those two in concatenation. So you just concatenate all the things from the first set to all the things of the second set, and be done with that. And with that, you can now interpret what I've shown you before as the semantics of regular expressions. Is that clear? It's always, I know, especially if you have heard all these formal things a few years ago, it might be a little bit overwhelming. So that's why I try to interpret these formulas for you. But I might get too speedy in future, so you might have to just call me to a halt and ask. Because if you are not sure what I mean with a certain thing, you can be sure that at least 5 or 6 others in the room are also not sure, and they will be thankful for you asking what that actually means. So, good. Don't be shy to ask questions. So, apart from the semantics of that, we will use these regular expressions later on when we talk about the way of how to convert them into finite automata even more, and you will see a certain way of denoting them. Particularly, you will see me using their syntax tree as a representation of those things, and there's no magic involved in that. It's just each of the sub-expressions is expressed as a tree in there, and yeah, if it's a composed tree, then it's composed expression, of course. And yeah, so the inner nodes are considered to be the operators of the regular expressions, and the leaves are considered to be the alphabet symbols or the input symbols from your program code. And yeah, that's that. Examples for regular expressions from, in this case, from Java. Well, those are, I think, taken from a parser generator for Java, and yeah, you can see that there is facilities in these parser generators to specify token classes and give them names. So this first token class is called LE. And it consists of, yeah, this thing over here. You see that in that particular parser generator, there's even more meta symbols in there. There's the minus operator, which gives ranges of characters, at least if they are used inside these square brackets. What does that mean? Well, the square brackets together with the ranges are considered to be just abbreviations of very large combinations of the pipe symbol and brackets of that. So if I have something like A to Z, that means A, B, C, D, and whatnot until you reach Z. So that's just an abbreviated way to write, and you can even use several of these ranges in those expressions. I'll remove them for you to see them better. So I have the range from small a to z, from large a to z, and also the underscore, and then there's once again a special case here. That's a backslash. That is a kind that has something to do with the dollar symbol being a special symbol in this parser generator, and if you actually want to specify that your regular expression has as input also the actual dollar symbol, you have to escape that with a backslash. So, yeah. what you have specified here is actually the class of letters. That's why they are called LE, and they are comprised of A to Z and A to Z in small and large caps, and underscore and dollar sign in that case. The next one is DI and comprises of the range of 0 to 9. DI might be digit, could be. Then the next line you find another definition, which is the identifier class, and that is considered to be, well, yeah, the next special symbol here is the meta symbol for denoting that what you have inside there is actually not a regular expression, but the name of an already established token class. So with that you refer to the token class letter in that case. And yeah, the identifier was an identifier. It is a letter followed by a clean star operator of letter or digit. So an identifier in that sense is considered to start with a letter and then be an arbitrary sequence of either letters or digits mixed widely. There's even more complex ones, like this one here, the float. Yeah, anyone fancies to try to decipher what that means? It's maybe a little bit much to do that in one go, so we might as well put order in there and try to do it one by one. Ah, okay. Maybe the second part, first part.
So, I wonder why they didn't use the plus operator here, for example. That would have reduced the simplicity for understanding the dot. Because what it says is there could be exist a number or not in the beginning, but there is definitely a dot and then a number. But it actually increased the complexity to that expression quite a lot. If you use a plus sign instead of the star, that first part is extremely simple.
Because if you see if a breakdown of the expression, we start with a digit, or we may start with a digit, we don't have to have any. Then we have the opening bracket, which has two choices, either the left one, where we start with a dot, which is prefix without a backslash, because it's a special syntax, followed by a digit, or we have a digit followed by a dot. And after that, we have maybe some digit more, which is also. We definitely do have a dot, but we probably don't have digits before, or we don't have digits after.
But you could have just expressed it as DI plus, and then dot, DI
but
plus,
you,
or,
no, no.
Or then, the, then have actually a dot and the DI.
You should consider that, for example, that is already a valid float.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I said the or would be the in the beginning instead. You actually just add the star to the rest, and you just have a one or, not a single with a star in the beginning.
I'm not sure where that.
Distribute the DI star on the inside of the or statement or the unite statement. And that would
so you can
end
up with multiple dots in this case.
Yeah. Oh yeah, maybe.
I would also say there's multiple dots in there.
You have more than one dot.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's nice to think about these things. That helps your understanding how what they actually mean. So. Apart from that, I think you already started with deciphering what that means. So with the core part is flip. Yeah. So that is kind of the core part of the first part of the specification, which because that is the one that cannot be left away. So there's no star involved in this one. This is used as kind of the. But by the way, it's not necessarily the case that there's just one solution for these things. So there can be several regular expressions that have the same thing. So it's just one way of writing that. Might not be the one that is actually used, but in that case it was. Anyway, the green box is kind of the center of the first part of the declaration, and it actually covers those two cases where you have four dot or number and dot. Or dot and number, which is the kind of the most minimal way to specify a float in that sense, and for that to cover all the floats, you can combine them on both sides with an arbitrary number of digits like those here. So you can just add digits then. For example, you can add them. Like there, or you can even continue here, or well, do the same thing to the other core part. So that covers the specification of this numeric part.
What about negative nodes?
Yeah, that is a question that is depending on the context of where you use that. There's cases where the languages specify the leading sign as being part of the token, or they might consider that as a unary operator that is trailing the thing. So depends on how your language is defined. In most cases, I would say it would be the unary operator, but yeah. Then there's the second part of the whole thing. This one over here, which is then the mantissa part, where that is an optional thing, but if it is there, then you for sure have something like an E in there, and then you might find either a plus or a minus, or might find nothing at all, but well, let's assume that there's a plus, and then you will then find some combination of numbers like that. Or you might even do without one of those if you have this question operator applied here. So yeah, that's the way how the question operator used as cancelling everything. So that is the way floats are possible to be defined. So that's for people at home. And with that, we are done with regular expressions. There's still finite automata to treat, and since the first tutorial sheet is covering them, I will just have you look at those. Finite automaton is a graph with labeled edges, which are directional, and the nodes are considered to be states, the edges are considered to be transitions, and the labels of the edges are to be interpreted as the input that is consumed when transitioning from the source state to the destination state. You can define the finite automata with a large tuple that tells you about what the components of these things actually are. Well, we have heard that there's states involved, so we have a finite set of states. There's alphabet of symbols for expressing what is consumed when doing the transition. So that is the sigma, it's a finite alphabet of inputs. Then you classify a few of those states as the start states, and a few of the states as the final states of your automaton. And then you have the actual transitions, which are considered to be a relation, or thus a set of three tuples of source state, input symbol, and destination state. With that, we have defined the non-deterministic finite automaton, and for the deterministic finite automaton, we say that the transition relation is now to be considered as a function, and our initial state is just one initial state and not several of those. And with if that is the case, then we call the automaton a deterministic automaton. Computations of these automata are paths in a graph. Accepting computations lead from a start state to an end state. The accepted word is the sequence of the labels that are passed on an accepting computation. So a computation that starts from an initial state and ends in an end state. Example is the one over here. That is a computation of the automaton. It ends in a final state. It starts in the start state and it runs through the labels A and B. Thus, it has accepted the word A and B, the word AB. Yeah. We can now try to come up with the semantics of the whole thing, but since we already have 10 to 4, I think now that you have at least seen how these things look like, I think people are already itching to go out here, so to leave the room. So I would say let's make a break here and continue next time. Have fun with the tutorial next week, and don't forget to vote for your favorite tutorial date. And yeah, with that, see you next week.